Welcome to the World Bank EdTech Podcast, a conversation on the use of technology and innovation in education globally. My name is Bob Hawkins, and I'm the Global Lead for Technology and Innovation at the World Bank. We're very pleased to have with us today Alex Twinomagisha, who recently joined our team, well, I guess over a year ago. It's fantastic to have you with us, Alex.
Thank you, Bob.
You have an incredibly rich history in the field of EdTech.
Getting into EdTech was a bit accidental. And interestingly, it all started with the World Bank. 20-something years ago, when I just finished my engineering degree at Makere in Uganda, there was a World Bank project that was looking for a young engineer to help put together some of the equipment. I showed up at the university and got to learn about the Africa Virtual University, or AVU. Initially focused on the technical IT side, so I set up a computer lab, connected it to the internet, probably one of the first public access connections with the university. I set up the satellite equipment. There were very few universities that offered computer science, computer engineering, and other STEM subjects. The idea was, could you use technology to bring professors from outside Africa to Africa? What today we call remote learning, distance learning using universities. My focus was very much on the technical side. Then I got interested in the education side. The more I looked into the technology, the more I realized that if I didn't understand the education side, then I was not going to be very effective, because technology is only a tool. At the end of the day, you really have to understand the problem you're trying to solve and then adapt that to solve that problem. I did further studies around education and technology, and then I've spent the last 20 years working on education technology.
We actually met as a result of AVU.
I was in 98. I became a short-term consultant, worked in DC for almost 4 years. We met when I first came to DC. You were one of the very few people that was working on anything education and technology related back then.
We were truly trying to bootstrap these programs. We were getting old World Bank computers, refurbishing them, sending them out to the universities as well as secondary schools across the world. Those are the ones that landed in your lap.
Those were ex-World Bank staff computers. In many universities, you had an open access area where you could access computers, internet. And I remember the project we were working on, World Links, actually was probably the first time that schools actually had access to computers, mostly in the developing world.
It was very much a precursor of MOOCs, where now universities are doing this all over the world, providing their courses online to anyone who wants to take them. What was your sense of that model and the introduction of computers at universities, particularly at a place like Makerere at the time?
It changed a lot of things. We have anecdotal evidence talking to people over the years. Some will tell you, I first touched my first computer because of AVU, or I learned how to use computers because of AVU, or I went to a school where we had this program by the World Bank to provide computers. These projects were the initial catalyst of not just EdTech, but technology in general. At that time, the emphasis was on basic access. Can you get your hands on a computer? You had the combination of this radical delivery method technology, but you had no internet. It was all satellite based. While distance education in the print format had existed in a few countries, this was the first time you were doing remote learning. The synchronous bit was easier to get started.
It's amazing to think back, looking at the challenges we've faced these last 4 months with COVID and the reemergence of synchronous radio and synchronous TV. AVU project was a fascinating first implementation of technology, where we had a lot of successes and some failures. On the success side, we changed the model from the synchronous delivery from external universities to creating a network, an INREN of African universities, for them to produce their own content and share amongst themselves. What was your sense at the time of this shift in educational, pedagogical partnership model for AVU?
There was a shift. It certainly helped accelerate NREN development in Africa. AVU used satellite technology to deliver synchronous broadcasts. We started thinking about, could we get online? To get online, you needed internet. AVU helped create the first bandwidth buying club that was multi-country, right, through the Partnership for Higher Education in Africa, this group of American foundations that funded it together with support from the bank, turning the learning centers that AVU had created into content centers. As the internet improved, moving more to online using learning management systems, those AVU centers in many of the universities are becoming this springboard for creation of e-learning courses and e-learning programs.
I'm amazed that the AVU model and the AVU organization is still up and running and vibrant in Africa. One of our biggest challenges was sustainability of the model and the business model. And I remember distinctly after one of the board meetings, we were kind of down because the expectations of how the model would play out were never realized. Part of the issue was that the mindset from a traditional university was brought into AVU. The same structures, the same hierarchies, the same departments were translated into a virtual university, which didn't make any sense. But we let it happen. And in fact, you remember what you told me after one of those board meetings? I said something to the effect that the board should have been more vocal in terms of highlighting some of the weaknesses and deficiencies in the business plan. And you pointed out, well, you let it happen. That struck me. It still resonates with me in terms of our role in the World Bank with regard to how much ownership and direction should the clients take with these programs. It's a difficult balance. I often wish that I had taken a stronger stance in terms of thinking more about the business model, but had taken the stance to let the team figure it out on their own.
You know, it's a delicate balancing act between providing advice, especially from outside any system, and listening to the system. When you're dealing with a disruptive situation, and AVU was pretty disruptive. AVU threatened the traditional universities. It could have gone one of two ways. It could have become actually a university. I think there was a missed opportunity there to become like an edX, an institution that's owned by other universities, and all these other universities contribute content. And I think that was the original idea around AVU. In a disruptive situation, especially using technology, you have to try and understand the fears and address those fears, but at the same time, providing very clear guidance. There was a lack of very clear guidance on what you could become. That's why I say the board could have played a better role. And now in COVID, everyone is asking what next. Providing very clear guidance is extremely important.
The disruption was a different way to deliver education, which I think we're going to be finding in the COVID era, that we'll have to rethink the ways that we've delivered education and the assumptions we have about how it should be structured. Another big challenge we are facing is the costing of models for remote learning. The next step on your journey, you did work at JESSE. I wonder if you can share why there's been so little progress on getting a better costing model for deployment and maintenance of EdTech solutions.
I joined JESSE, the Global eSchools and Communities Initiative, which was created out of the World Summit on the Information Society. This was in the early 2000s when the UN and the world community started thinking very seriously about the role of technology in development. Recognition that technology actually had an important role to play in addressing education challenges, including increasing access, improving quality. When I joined the organization, the work didn't actually start from costing. Work started from how do you make decisions about what technology to adopt? When I started looking at this challenge, we were really looking at scenario modeling. We modeled a number of key use cases. If you want to increase access, if you want to improve quality, if you want to reach the hard to reach people, if you want to improve teacher training, what sort of technologies are available? But then the question became, how much does this stuff cost and what's your return on investment? We found one organization that was doing work around costing, and that was the Consortium for School Networking in the US. It was at a very early stage. We decided to create a global public good, to create a total cost of ownership toolkit for education technology. I think it was one of the first comprehensive total cost of ownership. There's still not much out there in the developing world. The development community hasn't been very interested in education technology. Countries have been doing things on their own. There's really been no concerted international effort to really integrate technology in education. That's one of the things that's surprising, and I hope one of the things that will change post-COVID.
One of the challenges is that technology changes so quickly and costs are constantly decreasing, and yet capacity continues to increase. Cloud computing has de-risked and taken some of the complexity away from the schools themselves. Infrastructure as a service is underexploited in many of our projects, and the emergence of mobile and the shift from the actual cost of the device to the cost of data and data plans.
The cost model that we worked on while I was at JESSE was supposed to be more of a framework. Beyond the technology, there are other very critical costs. If you're really going to get a return on investment on technology, those other costs were things like teacher training, development of digital content, training the people who manage the technology, making sure that everybody has digital skills. It was a framework that was supposed to make it easier for countries to make intelligent decisions around investment. Technology has changed, and we always knew that the technology would change. In many ways, it's like a seesaw. Cloud computing is nothing but a fancy term for the old client-server networks. That's where computers began. Then it went down the personal computer. Then the pendulum swung back to having everything processed on big servers. It's really cloud, huge network of servers, and very little processing happening on the client, therefore making the client easy, cheaper, and much more accessible. That's really the future. The prediction is that more and more technologies that are enabled by computing will be more like a utility, like your electricity, your gas, your house. You would really think about the stuff that goes on top of it. It levels the world because it makes it easier for anyone to get started. We've seen like an explosion of these new companies that wouldn't exist if the barrier of entry was still very high. Back to your original question, that framework is still relevant.
That framework is still extremely relevant. Countries are still grappling with the holistic approach of ensuring that technology doesn't lead, but educational outcomes lead, and being very clear on what you want to see in terms of changes in the classroom or now in the home as a result of the investment in the technology, and taking into consideration not just the costs of the infrastructure itself, but also teacher training, the curriculum integration, incentives in the assessment. Having that type of model that makes sure that all of these aspects are taken into consideration is more relevant than ever. Your next transition was to the private sector, to Intel.
Intel was a particularly interesting and unique opportunity. Intel manufactures chips that they sell to computer manufacturers who then sell those devices to the end customer. Ingredient companies like Intel really have a very interesting role to create an ecosystem and to grow the market. The bigger the market, the more technology will be sold. Being at Intel aligned very well with what governments wanted to do because they saw digitization as a new future. Because the international development community was not very active in promoting digital solutions for development, the private sector stepped up. So you started seeing a lot of tech solutions that were really driven by the tech companies. We had this very big debate when Negroponte released the one laptop per child. There's some backstory there around the fight with Intel. One thing that really became very clear was that technology alone was not very useful. That technology really needed to address a specific problem. What education change do you want to see? I saw a shift of the big major players in the tech industry, the Intels, the Microsofts, begin to think much more seriously about what does it take for technology to make a difference? That ecosystem of you need teacher training, Intel created a teacher training program, so did Microsoft, so did a few others. You need content, the increasing efforts looking at content and digital content. My 8 years in Intel, I did not see the World Bank or all the other donors in the conversation the private sector was having with government. Working at Intel, the big difference, they measure everything. You have very clear KPIs that are simple and measurable. They track to those KPIs every day, every week. For me, that was kind of a shock. It made me realize how important data is. Being able to analyze that data, evidence-based decisions, was really critical. It's one thing that the education sector can learn from the private sector. With tens of thousands of, call it distribution locations, serving millions of customers every day. These are the students with tens, sometimes hundreds of thousands of employees, i.e. teachers. It's a very complex system. Managing that system without really using technology and being able to collect data and analyze the data almost in real time is mind-boggling. There is no private sector company that would survive a day if it wasn't leveraging that data. Data is critical. We've never been in a better position to collect and analyze data and make evidence-based decisions.
We have a lot of challenges with data. It's difficult to collect in a timely manner. A lot of our client systems are not interoperable, and we end up with a lot of different data silos. The data is not effectively used in real time to make decisions. Where do you start? Do you start with leadership making a priority? Do you start at the system level? Do you start with narrowing the amount of data that's collected and focus on a few key KPIs? Where would you start to help ministries more effectively use data based on your experience with Intel?
I don't think there's any one single starting point. Ultimately, everything starts or fails with leadership. Making leaders understand why it's important to use data for decision-making, and making them aware that it's actually much easier today to collect data. Most ministries of education don't have education policies that talks about how to use data. We will use data for the following decision making, or these are the KPIs that we have and we'll track, and therefore that requires that we collect data. At the policy and leadership level, there is a lot of awareness raising to be done. The other part that we need to work on is a framework that incorporates technology that people can take and implement, architectural plans for technology that clearly show how you collect data, what happens when you collect it, how you process it, how you make sure that data flows among the different systems, and how do you analyze it to create intelligent decision making. That's missing. We talk about EMIS, but I have never seen an EMIS blueprint.
We do a series of renovations. We start with one system, then we get a new system that might be detached, and then we get a third system that might integrate part of it, but might do something else, and we end up with a bit of a monstrosity. How do you pull back and create an architecture out of what is 180 different legacy systems that are all doing different things and in most cases not communicating with each other?
That problem has been solved in other sectors. There is clearly established methodologies around enterprise architecture that use to create this blueprint and look at, okay, in my plan, my blueprint, what do I have? And is it currently useful? What do I need to change? And what new things do I need to create so that systems can talk to each other and exchange data? With COVID, countries are going to buy even more management systems. The bank could work on a global public good, establishing a reference architecture for education information systems. And I hope that that's something we can work on together.
It's a huge priority. It's the area we've consistently invested in, education management information systems. There is a real opportunity to improve as more and more countries are investing in more systems that are either in the ministry or in private sector and oftentimes are not interoperable and don't communicate with each other. The bank started off with these pilots, AVU, WorldLynx, invested a lot in EMIS systems. We had some large projects in Turkey and Russia, but many of the projects got de-risked along the way. Now, you've just come back to the World Bank after being away. What are your impressions of coming back to the World Bank? What has changed and what do you see as opportunities for the future?
I think we had this conversation when I was coming back. Is the World Bank serious about digital technology and the potential of digital technology to make a difference? And I think that the answer is very resounding yes. Back during AVU and WorldLynx, a lot of people, not only in the bank, but the development arena, were saying, hey, we have much bigger problems than technology. Technology is a luxury. Today, more people, and maybe because technology has really permeated society, that everybody understands that we need technology to live today and to work, and to go to school. That's one of the biggest changes, that there is much more awareness of the role of technology.
We're in the largest edtech experiment ever with COVID. What's been surprising to you? What do you see as the risks and the opportunities these last 4 months of COVID and this explosion in technology and remote learning?
Why doesn't every country in the world have a learning management system? In 2020, why can't I learn online anywhere in the world? Why don't I have an option of studying anytime, anywhere? We know very well that countries that had made investments in the use of edtech, in remote learning, or that had sustained those investments over time, definitely coped better. They were able to go a bit faster. In many cases, they had some capacities. Why isn't every country have a very strong digital skills program? Today, we need digital skills to live and work. That COVID created an opportunity for countries to make the right investments. Now, the risk I see is that they've needle swing so far to technology. As much as I work on technology, I'm also very aware that human elements are more important. We can't leave the teachers behind. We can't replace the teachers. We have to build capacity within the system. So we have to make sure that people have the skills. We need to create ecosystems in countries to work on digital content. I am fully aware that it's not just technology. And we certainly cannot make technology the solution. There will be non-technological solutions. A very interesting one, even during COVID, is that print still has a role, right? If you want to be very technical, print is a form of technology, but you know what I mean. It's not a digital technology. That's the risk that we see a big swing. We need to understand that technology is one piece of the puzzle and that we also need to take care of. human capacity.
On your first question of why doesn't every country have an LMS, I think it comes down to equity issues, which has been laid bare during this COVID crisis of the huge digital divide and the new access divide that we're seeing with access to remote learning. A lot of countries, how could they invest in a system that would only reach 20% of their population? They needed to use those dollars to reach the maximum number of students. What we're seeing with COVID is the reemergence of radio and TV, along with LMS, learning management systems, and mobile. The equity issue is still very prevalent and something that needs to be addressed.
Having worked for both private sector, NGO development world, and having worked a lot with governments, sometimes I'm at odds with some of the policies that we have. There is a tendency for many people in the development world saying that government has no business doing business, that government should only create an enabling environment for the private sector where it makes sense. Having worked for the private sector, I think that government actually has a very important role to play as an investor, not just in the social services, but I don't see how we're going to close that digital divide if government does not make investments in closing the last mile. Yes, they can create incentives for private sector, but I think that government can also invest directly.
We have challenges in both connectivity and access to devices. What should be the role of government and what should be the role of private sector for bridging those gaps?
If we're talking about education, education is one of those interesting fields where who is the customer, who is the beneficiary? You have the government providing services that are consumed by students, but then you have parents in the middle. We have to figure out innovative financing mechanisms for addressing the divide, both for devices and connectivity. On the device side, there are a number of schemes around the world, everything from tax breaks to families to purchase devices, to subsidies, to vouchers, to even loans. We see loans more on the higher education side for students to get a device. We need to address those bits, but there's also other simple things that governments can do. There's a World Development Report that looked at digital dividends. I think that was in 2017. Digital technology is still highly taxed in some countries. The poorer the country, the higher the tax. And I remember working when I was at Intel on schemes to increase device ownership, where we worked with some governments to say, hey, you know, if you remove taxes on devices, you would make that device instantly 30 to 40% cheaper. That would increase uptake. And some governments listened and removed taxes and VAT on devices. The argument was, you need a certain level of penetration of device. No telco is going to invest in increasing reach or increasing capacity if there are not enough people to use that capacity or afford. If more people have devices, the telco has an incentive. When the network grows, other people have incentives to create content because now there's more people who can consume that content and better connectivity. It's all linked together. In some cases, government is just going to have to make the investment, at least maybe a catalytic investment, to buy a certain number of devices. For instance, they could say, we are going to make sure that every school or every teacher has a device. Some catalytic investments are going to have to be made.
Getting the right kind of financing and procurement model in ministries is critical. Beginning to think about infrastructure as a service and service level agreements is something that we can do more to develop models with our partners to figure out what is the most sustainable and effective financing model. So we got a lot of work ahead of us, Alex. It's going to be a busy year, but we have to also have to take time to reflect. So do you have any books that you would share that have been compelling reads over the past number of weeks?
Yes, actually, Bob, I do. I've been reading a book, Excellence Wins, A No-Nonsense Guide to Becoming the Best in a World of Compromise. It takes the ethos of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. They are renowned for uncompromising service. They really strive to provide the best. I think that there are lessons to be learned there. Irrespective of what you do, irrespective of what field you're in, how can you really think about doing the best that you can? Especially for those of us who are in a public service role, how do we make sure that we do not compromise on quality of technical service that we offer?
How have you applied this to your life so far?
I'm questioning some of the things that I'm doing. I am reading a lot more about how we can be effective in remote learning, or looking ahead and trying to see what you can do better or best. I've been thinking about the future of education post-COVID, and how do we better serve these children? How do we make sure that every child has an opportunity? There is going to be elements of technology and remote learning. The school has to change in some ways. Maybe we have to blur these boundaries of the school and the walls. I am still reflecting.
This has been a great conversation. Do you have any call to action for our listeners? Anything you'd like to motivate people to do?
We are in the middle of a grand experiment. Let's experiment. Let's not fear to fail, but rather let's learn from failure.
I like that. Go forth boldly and don't be afraid to fail. Alex, yep. This has been a fantastic conversation. It's awesome having you on the team. I've learned so much from you and I'm excited for the next year and learning even more. We got a huge amount on our plate and it's going to be a lot of fun going forth boldly with you on the team.
Likewise here, Bob. Thank you.